Welcome to the Sunshine Economy on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening.
Let me show you one of these.
Walking around a Fort Lauderdale neighborhood with Thomas Chavonk, you get the sense this is just an extension of his day job. He works at a science lab at the University of Florida's Research and Education Center nearby. He's quick with his flip-blade utility knife, pulling it out to peel back a layer of bark. He's looking for termites. He's got no problem finding them.
Haha, look at that. Here, see, termites have fed on it. They nibbled on it. And basically, it's all it took to kill the colony that was in the ground here.
It helps he knows what he's looking for. Chavonk's specialty as a research assistant scientist at UF is subterranean termites. We'll talk about other bugs bothering us in South Florida, mosquitoes and fruit flies, later on. But the termites Thomas concentrates on are relatively new here in South Florida.
Okay. See this?
It was 1980 when a colony of one species, the Formosan subterranean termite, was found in Hallandale Beach. Another type, the Asian Luna. Subterranean, was found in 1996 near a church in Miami.
Luna!
We're in a backyard in Fort Lauderdale, just east of I-95. We're at the base of a pine tree. You're flipping off some of the exterior bark here with your utility knife and have uncovered live termites, live subterranean termites. What does this tree tell you about the trajectory of this pest and the threat of a neighborhood like this?
Well, things is, because it's a subterranean termite, chances the colony is not just in that tree. The colony is probably in the ground, maybe just feeding on that house next year, or maybe the house next door, because we don't know what's the extent of the colony.
Today, both the Formosan and Asian termite species have spread, but it's only here in South Florida. This is the only place where the two mix. Further north, it gets too cold for the Asian termite, into the Keys, too wet for the Formosan termite. It's primarily in Miami-Dade and Broward counties where the two overlap, and you can't stop biology with the border.
And the threat of this colony to the neighborhood?
This colony, the threat is probably just the, let's say, two houses around here, two, three houses around. It can be, the foraging territory can go all the way up to 200, 300 feet. So it can be here and feeding three houses down there, avoiding the two houses in between. Who knows? This is very unpredictable what they can do.
That's the threat this year. You go through a spawning cycle in the next couple of weeks. In another year, go through another spawning cycle, and another year, another spawning cycle. As that continues, this colony could clearly have a vector to the west, to the south, and to the north.
That's the thing is, this colony, if left alone like this, is probably going to swarm this year. Maybe have 20,000 winged termites, and you only need two of these, one male, one female, to create a new colony. So if it's doing this every year for the next 10 years, you're probably going to have like daughter colonies spreading all around, not just westward, but northward, depending on the wind and how we carry them. But eventually, this colony can eat 20 houses within 20 years because not just the colony itself, but the daughters of this colony. So by killing this colony, we prevent potentially new colonies to show up somewhere else.
But colonies of these two types of termites are showing up in new places. New research from the University of Florida that will be released next week will predict a significant expansion of the subterranean termites in South Florida in the decades to come. Last spring, Chavonk found these two separate types of termites are getting together.
To our surprise, they are mating.
That's Nanyao Su. He's a distinguished professor of entomology at the University of Florida. He's based in Fort Lauderdale.
You're grimacing when you're talking about these two termite species coming together to form a third species?
Well, it's probably a hybrid. Okay. It's just like when the horse and the donkey mate, they create a mule type of thing. But we're not sure that is the case or not.
It's only been a year or so since they first discovered this hybrid termite, this so-called super termite. But the threat to South Florida property remains very real.
They have what we call hybrid vigor, meaning that they are more aggressive. So you have those hybrid colony in your property, they maybe have a bigger population. They may eat wood more aggressively, and they will live here for 20 to 30 years. That alone is quite a threat for people in this overlap area. We're talking from date all the way to Palm Beach County here.
Now, globally, termites do about $40 billion a year in damage to property. Lucky us, South Florida, the only place in the continental United States where these two destructive underground termites, the Phomosan and Asian species, live together. And they're spreading. Again, research assistant Thomas Chivonk.
As we've been monitoring the activity throughout the urban area of South Florida from Homestead to Jupiter, over time we've been able to see the spread of the species. Remember, they're invasive. So when they first arrived, they were only located in very small pockets of urban area, mostly close to ports or canals. They've been coming by boats. I mean, we brought them here unintentionally, unfortunately, but they've been moved around by boats, mostly yachts, expensive boats, you know. Over the time, maybe we had one, two colony in the 80s, in the 90s, maybe we have 10, 20, and now in 2000, maybe 100, and now we have 10,000, maybe a million colonies in area. But so it's increased the density at location where it was originally introduced, like Miami, Hollywood, Fort Lauderdale, Riviera Beach. So these areas are, we do find a high density of termite colonies. But now, in addition to this, it spread geographically, which means it goes more inland, westward. As you can see, the Miami, the Kendall area has it now. And it's going to spread probably throughout the urban area.
Just 15 years ago, these termites had small clusters in downtown Miami, Hollywood, and Riviera Beach. By last year, a map of where the termites live showed they have spread from Miami Beach to Palmetto Bay, Pompano Beach to Pembroke Pines, Parkland to North Palm Beach. And in the past 15 years, the populations have seen exponential growth. Now, the prediction is half of the buildings in South Florida will be at risk of being infested with at least one type of these subterranean termites by 2040. Half of the buildings here will be in neighborhoods where the subterranean termites live. This is the forecast that will be released from the University of Florida March 1st. Today, Chivonk's research shows about 7% of structures are at risk.
When we look at the growth of population, it's right now it's growing exponentially. It hasn't reached a plateau yet. So we do expect this to keep increasing until it's saturated, basically, throughout South Florida.
Now, since these bugs were first found here, the percent of at-risk buildings in South Florida, it's been doubling.
Pretty much. That's pretty much it.
So what's the economic threat of these underground pests?
It's definitely increasing.
Definitely increasing, says Dr. Nanyao Su, the distinguished professor of entomology. He's been studying termites here since 1985.
It's increasing not just because of termite per se, but we also provide the environment for them to habitate. The more and more people moving in, more houses being built. House is most expensive possession for every household, and then so termites are going after those most expensive property you have. So over the time, if things doesn't change, we are going to getting worse and worse.
The termite threat most Floridians are familiar with is from the drywood termite. Now, these are the pests that can live in a wooden picture frame or a kitchen cabinet drawer. They're small colonies that live just in that piece of wood. You take out the piece of wood, or worst case, tent and fumigate your home to get rid of them. Subterranean termites, they're harder to find. They live underground outside your home, maybe even in your neighbor's yard. And they live in much bigger colonies, a million termites maybe, instead of just a few thousand. And they do more damage and they do it faster.
And they can do, just within 3 months, as much damage than drywood termites would do in 10 years. That is the real problem, that if drywood termite is a norm now that is everywhere, imagine 15, 20 years from now where subterranean termite is a norm, except instead of having damage in 10 years, you have it in just a few months. This is what really hurts the most.
We're now in one of the subterranean termite labs at the University of Florida's Research Center near Fort Lauderdale.
It's nice and moist because this unfortunately the conducive, the best condition for termites to be happy. Now, keep in mind, it's hard to kill them in the field. It's actually hard to keep them alive in the lab. So it's
the irony of science. This lab has low tables with plastic bins. Sealed inside the bins, soil and wood playing host to colonies of termites. Loops of plastic tubing connect to flat panels mimicking termite tunnels stretching from one of the colonies to a tree or maybe to your home. The research here is focused on new baiting strategies in hopes of finding better ways to battling the bugs.
And what we're doing here, we're trying to test, improve the baiting method that has been developed in this lab by Dr. Nanyao Su. The bait, the concept of a bait, is we put the tube in the ground with the active ingredient, and we let it sit there until termites found it and started feeding on it. The beauty of it is it uses a tiny amount of insecticide, and only termites are affected by it. Nothing else. It's probably one of the greenest technology in terms of environmental impact. It's like minute.
Now, the poison doesn't kill the subterranean termites right away. Instead, it tries to use biology in its favor. A couple of things to know about termites here. They're social bugs, which means they share their food. They also have to molt, like a crab. Termites have to shed their skin. The insecticide Shavonk is testing prevents termites from doing that, killing them. But the bait can take 30 to 90 days, maybe longer. So that's why this lab is experimenting with the goal of speeding it up.
Our goal here is not just to protect houses, it's really to eliminate a whole colony as fast as possible. In the long term, you may actually reduce the overall termite population in the whole block just by having these baits around your house.
And that's the big goal of battling the termite pest. Thomas Shavonk at his suburban termite lab in Davie. Still to come on our program, the all-out war against mosquitoes in the Florida Keys, using all the tools of a modern battlefield.
It's like guerrilla warfare. I don't think they have the troops, equipment, aircraft, helicopters, and our airplanes, trucks.
Welcome back to the Sunshine Economy. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening this week. We're talking about bugs and money today. The outbreak of the Zika virus in Brazil and its host have renewed attention to a familiar pest in South Florida, the Aedes aegypti mosquito. It's just one of the species of mosquitoes South Florida battles with millions and millions of dollars each year. Now, there have been no cases of the Zika virus contracted within the United States. The Centers for Disease Control reports 82 cases nationwide as of last week. About a third of those are in Florida, and all of them were infected overseas. But it has brought awareness again to this annoying six-legged winged bloodsucker that have been targeted by taxpayers for years. Broward County voters approved spending tax dollars on the bugs back in 1933, mandated to control mosquitoes. Today, Broward's mosquito control budget is $1.3 million. Move south, and the mosquito problem and budget booms. Monroe County will spend almost $16 million this year on fighting mosquitoes throughout the Florida Keys. WLRN's Nan Klinger reports from our southernmost bureau.
For 20 years, Stephen Smith has been among those responsible for the fight against mosquitoes in the Florida Keys. He's one of the five elected commissioners on the Florida Keys Mosquito Control Board. That's right. Battling the bug is so important to the Keys, the rulemakers are beholden to voters. Smith didn't run for public office because of any great interest in entomology, though.
I was trying to read a book in my backyard and being eaten alive by mosquitoes. So someone said, call mosquito control. I didn't even know what it was.
Smith called, and the inspector who came to his house recommended that he go to the hardware store and buy a handheld fogger. As he tells the story, he says that's when he decided there had to be a better way. So he entered politics and ran for a seat on the board that oversees the district and its annual budget of almost $16 million. Smith's mosquito district includes much of Key West, though he, like all members of the Mosquito Control Board, was elected countywide. I recently sat down with him to talk about mosquito control in the Keys.
It's like guerrilla warfare. We have a lot of troops on the ground. We go door to door looking for standing water and breeding areas. When I was elected, we did about 80% fogging or using adulticide, which is a nice word for insecticide. Today, we do about 20% of that, and we do about 80% larvaciding, which is something that just prevents the mosquito larva from becoming an adult. It's safe. It's environmentally friendly. It is a natural bacteria that is in dirt. So we're very pleased with that, and it's about 10 times cheaper.
And how is that different from how they do it in mainland South Florida?
I don't think they have the troops. I don't think they have the manpower to go door to door. whenever they have a mosquito outbreak or problems, most of the county programs contract with the company to do their spraying, either by truck or by aircraft. So they have a mosquito or a heavy rain incident, they would call their contractor, they would get on a rotation schedule, and if the company had equipment in place, they would dispatch aircraft or trucks. If they didn't have equipment, then you would sit and wait. We're blessed because we have a heavy rain weekend, rain or something, we can have our helicopters and our airplanes up the very next day and do the larva sighting. We only have 4 days to get the larva sight in the water, then the larva quits feeding and it becomes an adult, and then you're using again pesticides.
Can you describe kind of a day in the life of our district, if there is such a thing as a typical day?
A typical day, we have several operations. I'll talk about the offshore operations. Those team members will gather, hitch up a John boat, pull it to a ramp, and they will go out to some of the offshore islands where we have permission from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife to actually put our feet on their property. We're the only mosquito control program, by the way, in the nation that can do that. They will climb over mangrove trees and roots for about 30 minutes to get into the center of the island and look for breeding sites, and then we do larvicide treatment of those. So those guys are on the water a lot. They're going island to island. They get soaking wet. It's not a glamorous job. There are mosquitoes on the islands, and they get bit. Then we have our domestic inspectors who would knock on your door, introduce themselves, and walk with you through their yard looking for breeding areas such as bromeliads, buckets of water, a tarp over a lawnmower or a gas grill. A mosquito only needs about a quarter cup of water to emerge as an adult. So they spend their day going door to door, and then they log everything they see. And of course, we have to record every bit of any kind of chemical we use.
What does an average homeowner in the Keys pay for mosquito control?
It runs about $50 per 100,000 of taxable value. Take or give a few cents. My home, for example, I pay $180 a year for mosquito control. And you know, it's funny because sometimes we get attacked for our budget. And I remind people, if we cut 25% off of our budget, right off the top, I would save $45 a year. I could maybe get dinner or lunch at Outback for two of us and tip, and we would no longer have a domestic program. We would have nobody going door to door because there'd be no money to do it.
What would life in the Keys be like without mosquito control?
If you chose to live here without mosquito control, you would run from your car to your house. If you had groceries, you would give each of your kids a bag of groceries and say, on the count of three, we're going to run. Some of the conks that are like in their 80s that grew up here, those lucky enough to have screens in their homes, would talk in the evenings of holding their hand up to the screen and then pulling it back, and there would be a complete imprint of their hand by mosquitoes on the outside of the screen.
Even before this latest attention to mosquito control, thanks to the Zika virus, the Keys District has been debating new technologies to control the bug. That includes a proposed test of genetically modified mosquitoes by the British company Oxitec. That proposal is waiting on approval from the FDA, and it's gotten widespread and vocal opposition from residents of Key West and the Lower Keys. Again, Stephen Smith, vice chair of the Florida Keys Mosquito Control Board.
I have to say, deep in my heart, our community does not want a genetic mosquito release here. And if the final vote came up tomorrow, I cannot support doing it because it's against what the bulk of the citizens and what our city government is wanting. I don't think it's a bad thing. I don't think they're going to introduce anything into our ecosystem here that we would regret down the road. But again, if you don't have support for doing things, then you have to take a long look at it. What we do is labor intensive. It will always be labor intensive. And the Aedes aegypti will never be killed by aerial or truck spraying because she is not out flying during the times that we have to do treatment. So to get her, we have to have, you know, men and women on the ground. And you can't replace them with a genetic modified mosquito, and you can't replace them with a robot. They have to be able to lift up lids and look for water and educate people on how to dump it.
That was Stephen Smith of the Keys Mosquito Control Board. The Keys Mosquito District isn't planning any extra operations to combat the Zika virus because the district has been going all out against Aedes aegypti since a dengue fever outbreak in Key West more than 5 years ago. Both viruses are carried by the same mosquito species. I'm Nancy Klingener in Key West.
My name is Michael Doyle, Executive Director of the Florida Keys Mosquito Control District, and I'm calling from Brasilia, Brazil.
Mike Doyle is the guy for mosquitoes in the Keys. He's the top mosquito guy, the director of the Florida Keys Mosquito Control Board. He was invited to Brazil to talk about the bugs. It's a fight that he expects will cause him to dip into his budget reserves.
We're already 15-20% over our normal chemical budget, and we've had to do these large-scale helicopter sprays over Key West with this bacterium, BTI, already, and that's never happened in January, February, and we've already had to do a few of those. So it's looking like it's going to be a very busy season, and we need to keep the Aedes aegypti down, numbers down, in order to prevent any problems and keep it a safe and enjoyable place to come visit.
What kind of technology, what kind of know-how can be exported from your crew covering the Florida Keys, and what could be imported, perhaps? What kind of new techniques are you seeing or hearing in Brazil that you may want to give a shot up and down the Keys?
The work that we've been doing is a large-scale larviciding, and that is using a non-toxic bacterium that kills only mosquitoes, and we perfected a technique to treat by helicopter. This mosquito is notorious for hiding both the larvae and the adults in little out-of-the-way places that defy most mosquito control efforts.
This is the Aedes aegypti. This is the aegypti breed. Yeah, it's tough. It's tough to get at it with helicopters.
It's tough to get it with anything. It's kind of like the cockroach of the mosquito world. It prefers to hide inside if it can. If it's outside, it goes under the porch or in the shed or anything like that. But fortunately, even in the Keys with our dense housing and lush vegetation, we found a method with the helicopter to put this bacterium that looks like we're hitting about 80% of the of those tiny containers, and we're talking thousands upon thousands of containers, drifting it with just the right droplet size into those. And how that could integrate here is that with many of these sterile insect techniques that they're looking at, either genetic or using radiation or a bacterium, they need to knock the adult the population down to start these programs effectively. And using tools like the ones that we have for an initial knockdown of the population, which then in order to bring in one of these other control methods could be very useful for them.
We know there's been a conversation and debate about using genetically modified mosquitoes to try to control the mosquito population. A lot of experiments happening, still waiting for the official okay, if there will come, to release those mosquitoes in the Keys. Some of those same techniques are being used in Brazil. As you've talked to your colleagues, what have they been telling you about these kinds of techniques?
That has been successful. The attempts to control Aedes aegypti using brute force, going door to door, treating containers, is possible. Say somewhere like Key West, where we only have 25,000 residents, but when you're looking at Mexico City or Sao Paulo or any other large city, that type of work becomes overwhelming quickly, and so the focus is now shifting towards this sterile insect technique, sterile males that then mate with the local population of female mosquitoes. It prevents the next generation, and you do that repeatedly over many months to push the population down.
Mike Doyle, director of the Florida Keys Mosquito Control District. Still to come in our program, what one of the biggest county budgets to battle mosquitoes gets you.
Most of the time, when we're being successful, people just don't even notice it. They don't realize what we've controlled and what they've been protected from.
This is the Sunshine Economy. Bugs and money, mosquitoes, fruit flies, and termites. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening. The fight against mosquitoes usually has some downtime this time of year. The dry season can give the bug inspectors and technicians some rest, but not necessarily this year. It's been wet and warm during our usual dry season. And the wet and warm weather, that's an ideal environment for the bugs. In southwest Florida, across the Everglades from us, Lee County has one of the largest budgets for mosquito control in the country, $24 million. That money goes toward things like treating more than 56,000 acres of salt marsh. That's a prime breeding ground for the bugs. But this unusually wet winter has the county guessing what their operations will look like for the rest of the year. And like all mosquito control districts, they're keeping an eye out for the Zika virus. Topher Forehands has more from our sister station, WGCU, in Fort Myers.
Shelley Redovan with the Lee County Mosquito Control says there are few areas of the state that have preserved as much natural land as the county.
There just isn't anything like Lee County and most of Florida.
But preserving so much land also means lots of mosquitoes. The county fights mosquitoes by targeting the larva first, and then, if they hatch, the adult mosquitoes. It's a fight that uses helicopters, planes, trucks, equipment, and manpower. And that adds up. Consider sending up a plane for night spraying.
And just with the pesticides for that plane, and it's going to cover about 32,000 acres, is going to be around $20,000. So every time you put out a plane, you know that at least that much is going out in pesticides.
Treatments and success depends on the year. If an initial treatment doesn't go well, or say there's weather that stops a helicopter from flying, Redovan says they hear pretty quickly from residents and business owners on the coast about a new wave of mosquitoes. But
most of the time, when we're being successful, people just don't even notice it. They don't realize what has hatched, what we've controlled, and what they've been protected from.
What has changed the mosquito controls calculus this year is the wettest January since 1932. The South Florida Water Management District says about 9 inches of rain fell in January.
We're spending a lot more on pesticides at the beginning of the year than what we normally would.
This has mosquito control wondering if it will need to dip into its reserves when more mosquitoes show up during the summer. It depends on if rain keeps falling once the wet season comes. Lee County is also on the lookout for Zika virus. It's one of the Florida counties that has seen confirmed cases of the virus, though none have been contracted here. All of the cases were contracted outside of the U.S. Still, mosquito control is on the lookout for the bugs in the areas where people with the virus live.
If there's any of those mosquitoes present, regardless of any other factors, then we will go ahead and treat it so that we can protect the people who live in that area so that our local mosquitoes aren't picking up, say, the malaria or dengue that this person brought back with them.
Redovan says so far that strategy has been successful. I'm Topher Forehands in Fort Myers.
Still to come when the Sunshine Economy continues, the bug that shut down 85 square miles of one of South Florida's biggest industries.
Oriental fruit fly is one of the most devastating pests in the world. And this was the largest oriental fruit fly infestation in the state of Florida in its history.
We're back on the Sunshine Economy on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening this week. Paul Hornby was in Raleigh, North Carolina in August when he got an email on his iPhone. It included a photo of a fruit fly trap from South Miami-Dade County. You know, he didn't have to zoom in to see the pests. He didn't even have to count them. Usually these traps find just one or two of the fruit flies. This picture, it had almost four dozen. He knew he had a problem.
When you're seeing that number, it obviously takes on a different tone. Obviously, there was something bigger here than we're typically used to dealing with.
And Hornby has dealt with a lot of pests. That's his job, after all. He's the Florida Plant Health Director for the U.S. Department of Agriculture. This particular fruit fly, the Oriental fruit fly, it's a special kind of curse. It can take up residence, called a host, on just about every type of fruit and vegetable grown in the United States.
This particular fruit fly has over 400 hosts. Given the locality where it was detected, was also troubling. In a residential setting, that's one thing. But when you're in the heart of the commercial production area, like the Redlands and Homestead, South Florida, that does take on a much different challenge. Again, it's nothing that we can't overcome, but it does require some additional thought and deliberation and tactics and how to respond to that.
This outbreak led to a quarantine of about 85 square miles in South Dade for 5 months. That quarantine was lifted about 10 days ago.
Hey, Tom. Jesse, how are you?
Of
course. No, I'm glad that you called.
Less than a week after the state declared the Oriental fruit fly emergency over, I met Jesse Capote between two fields of white sweet potatoes. This particular field wasn't affected by the fruit fly. On this day, Capote was here to watch a new piece of planting equipment his crew was experimenting with.
I didn't want to miss the opportunity.
Of course, yeah.
After a career as a lawyer, Capote now helps run the family business, J&C Tropicals. They grow and distribute all kinds of fruits and vegetables. Some of the growers they work with had their fields and groves shut down for the duration of the quarantine.
I've heard some numbers thrown around internally in terms of sales, probably a couple million in sales. Cost-wise, we haven't really sat to tally up the effort to spray and to get things in order. But I think the biggest hurt was our grower base. And a lot of these folks are small operators and they can't afford these type of financial hits.
Avocados, mamés, guavas, passion fruits, dragon fruits, they were all included in the quarantine zone, crops that help fuel a $700 million a year fruit industry here in South Florida. For packers like J&C Tropicals, it had to have segregated space to deal with quarantined fruit. There were additional sanitation and washing protocols and shipping requirements to make sure that the fruit fly wasn't spreading.
I mean, it was a lot. I mean, to be honest with you, there were times where I knew that at the end of the day, it wasn't going to make a difference whether you let the fruit go to waste or actually do some of these. But You had to go through. You had to do the best you could for your grower.
These pests have all come in and caused tremendous damage to our crops here in Florida, and it's significant economic damage.
That's Tony DeMari. He's vice president of the DeMari Homestead Company, one of the largest growers, packers, and distributors of fruit and vegetables in the state. The Oriental fruit fly this fall was just the latest pest his industry has had to deal with.
When you add in the additional pests and diseases that are coming into this state and damaging our crops, and from citrus to tomatoes to avocados with the Asian beetle down here that's caused significant damage in the Homestead area, these costs continue to add. And, you know, we're in a stage in our industry down here that we can't afford any more increased costs.
Can you push those costs through the supply chain at all?
We cannot. I mean, you know, we're dealing with highly perishable commodities and vegetables and tropical fruits, and they have short windows as far as shelf life is concerned. Those are just costs that we absorb.
DeMari and others in South Florida's ag industry point out the pests they face are often foreign, imported here from somewhere else. It's a consequence of world travel and global trade.
You're going to wake up, you know, 5-10 years from now, and you're going to wonder what happened to the ag industry in Homestead. Well, you know, they were devastated cumulatively because of the Oriental fruit fly and white fly and thrips palmi and western flower thrips that all came from abroad. You know, we didn't want to address it. We, failed to recognize it, and you wiped out a whole industry. And if you're not careful, that is a reality down the road.
Of course, tighter controls would mean more money for inspectors and technology at ports of entry like seaports and airports. DeMari says putting a tariff on foreign products that can host foreign pests would help pay for protection efforts, including repaying growers if their crops are hurt by these foreign bugs.
If you were to sell DeMari tomatoes to Argentina, if Florida oranges get sent to Peru, you know how world trade negotiations happen. It is a give and take between countries. Would you, as an American producer, American grower, American exporter of food products, would you be willing to pay the same type of tariff to get your product into Argentina so as not to export American pests?
I think fair is fair. It's got to be equitable on both sides or it doesn't work. You can't expect to tax or impose a duty on imports, you know, coming into the United States and not have the same similar duties if a given country chooses to do so on American exports.
For now, back in Florida, there are 56,000 traps hung around the state looking for 6 different species of fruit fly pests. None of those 6 are native to Florida. The federal government's share of the program, $13 million. Unfortunately for the ag industry, shutting down 85 square miles of land in South Dade for 5 months because of the pest is not unique. Again, Tony DeMari with DeMari Homestead.
This is not new. We've been battling whitefly, different species of thrips that carry many different viruses. In the Homestead area, we now have three different viruses associated with either the thrips palmi or western flower thrips. And again, this pest has been brought in by, in some cases, the plant material coming in from South America and other foreign countries into this state. And it's created an infestation in some cases. And we're seeing more and more new viruses popping up. And we have very little controls. And these are devastating viruses that are, in some cases, wiping out 100% of crops that are subject to these different viruses from these pests. So this is something that is not new, Tom. This has been going on for decades. But I truly do see it getting worse.
Back out in the fields of South Dade, Jesse Capote of J&C Tropicals knows risks are a fact of life for his business.
You know, there were freezes. When I was a kid, it was a freeze that came through. Or in the early 80s, you know, there was a glut of in the commodities markets, and we almost went bankrupt at least a couple times in the last 30 years. So whether it's weather or whether it's just the economic condition, whether it's urban sprawl that's taking up land, you name it, you're always dealing with some challenge.
And the latest challenge, the latest lockdown, the quarantine. It was a success, according to Paul Hornby, the Florida plant health director with the U.S. Department of Agriculture. But consider the constant threats in a dynamic economic environment that is as globally connected as South Florida is.
In all honesty, we can hit the pause button a little bit, but we're back at business. We're running our traps as we always do, and just unfortunately waiting for the next event. And the next event will happen. Yeah.
How does an agency become more proactive in these cases? In the case of, you know, these six pests that are not mm-hmm. native, they're obviously been imported here.
Right. So I think our trapping program and our commitment to that on the federal side, we invest about $13 million a year in our fruit fly detection program. That's running those traps. We also have a preventative release program with the Mediterranean fruit fly where we drop sterile flies throughout the year. That's a very proactive approach, and I think our trapping program is also proactive. But I certainly understand where that might be sensed more as a reactive status. So what we need to do is work harder with our outreach efforts. The state of Florida, in collaboration with the USDA and Customs and Border Protection, they have a Don't Pack a Pest campaign. That's a great initiative to educate the traveling public. In many cases, these introductions are a result of not permitted cargo, regular cargo that comes in. These are maybe a traveler or somebody offshore that sends a package to a family member, a couple mangoes, they happen to be infested. It's not deliberate or intentional, they just don't know. In some cases, it might be deliberate, somebody wanting to smuggle in a small lot of fruit. In either case, education is key. The other end of this, our partners with Customs and Border Protection, they have the inspection environment. They're in charge of that. And consider the volume of international mail, courier packages that arrive in this country every day. I'm sure there are millions of packages. Can you look at every single one? No. However, they do a great job with the resources that they have. They utilize technologies with X-ray, detector dogs, canines. They're very successful in finding a lot of quarantine material that comes in that shouldn't come in. They also do a very good job on targeting. And we know when certain crops are in season offshore from high-risk areas, so you can focus on packages coming from those countries at a certain time of year. The system obviously isn't perfect because we continue to have these incursions, but folks are trying to do their best due diligence with the resources that they have. But I think a combination of enhancing those resources, those technologies that are in the pipeline, as well as an informed citizenry are the keys to being as proactive as we can.
You've been through a number of these.
Mm-hmm.
This quarantine for the Oriental fruit fly in South Dade, put the threat in perspective.
Sure. One that was really bad was back in 97, 98, and this was the Mediterranean fruit fly. This ended up spanning five counties, and it bled into the following year. So it almost took 2 years at a cost of, I think it was close to $25 million. That was a huge, huge outbreak. And that was actually the impetus to establish our preventative release program. So something good did come out of that unfortunate situation, the sterile med fly. Most of these incursions that we have are in residential areas. They don't typically trigger major quarantine actions. They're almost transparent to the public out there. It's when you get in these commercial scenarios, it does become very challenging. And we are very sensitive to the impacts on the growers. We want to minimize those as best as possible, but still be responsible, eradicating these in as quick a time as possible. Unfortunately, when this occurred, we were getting into the fall season, cooler temperatures, that expands the life cycles. And I think over the 45 days that we were continuing to catch flies, we would go a couple days, not find any. We would start a life cycle, then find one. And it just, a lot of angst was building, both with the industry and with us, quite honestly, internally. We wanted to start to turn that corner. But after 45 days, and in the grand scheme of things, that isn't bad, we were able to turn that corner and get those three life cycles in and release this quarantine.
Paul Hornby, the Florida State Plant Health Director for the U.S. Department of Ag. Still to come, we are a buggy place here after all, aren't we?
This is the reality. You come in Florida, be prepared, because they're going to have a lot of bugs and they're going to come in the houses.
We're back on the Sunshine Economy on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening this week. The story of modern South Florida is a story of fighting bugs. Conquering South Florida's landscape meant tolerating pests of all kinds that are fed by our sunny, moist climate. Aren't those the same features that inspired Henry Flagler to bring his railroad south from Palm Beach, first to Miami, and then ultimately all the way to Key West? It's been said two things slowed down Flagler's dream of becoming a reality in early 20th century Monroe County: the lack of alcohol and mosquitoes. How serious do we take our bugs and the interference with the big economic engines here? Well, consider that the homepage for the Monroe County Tourist Development Council, responsible for attracting people from all over the world to come and visit the Florida Keys, it includes a hyperlink titled Mosquito Protection. Now, it's not prominent on the page, but there it is, nestled at the bottom among all the other hyperlinks for arts and culture, diving and snorkeling and fishing, and mosquito protection. We have the love bug, which drivers hate, the kissing bug that can carry a deadly parasite if they bite you, carpenter ants and fire ants, black flies, white flies, and cockroaches from four continents. Bugs, they're a nuisance for most of us, creepy, crawly things that we smash, spray, or trap to get rid of. But consider it from a scientific point of view. Sure, these pests pose something significant in terms of economic threats, but they're also creatures of survival to be admired, to be studied, as much as to be controlled. Take termites.
Well, termites is very unique.
That's Nanyao Su. We met him earlier in the program, a distinguished professor of entomology at the University of Florida based in Davie.
If you think about it, they are the only one of the few animals who can digest woody materials. And if you think of what woody material is, you and I, animal, we live as a vegetable or meat animal. The animal actually is also eat plant. So the energy we have ultimately comes from sun. It's photosynthesized by plant, right? But no more than 95% of the photosynthesis product are woody material we can eat. So we only use about 5% of the photosynthesis solar energy coming from the sun, and the other 95% basically just sitting there. Well, termite is one of the few animals who can unlock the energy of 95% of photosynthesis energy and bring that energy inside their body. So when they're eaten by the other animal, that energy will release to our ecosystem. That's what the termite does in our intestine. So they are very beneficial in the forest. And they are doing their thing. And the unfortunate thing is that we human beings go into the forest, we create the wood, and destroy all the environment, we build a house on top of it. I'll tell my how to find the food. They come to your house. And that's what's happening here. So you can't blame them, but if you invest your house, you want to protect it, unfortunately, we just have to kill them.
Dr. Su has dedicated his professional life to studying termites and investigating better ways of controlling them, killing them. If he comes to your house, expect him to look at things a little bit different, informed by years of watching termites and the damage they can do in South Florida.
Well, yes. When you start looking suspicious of termites, every piece of wood on the ground, we want to flip them over and to see if there's termite underneath or not. I go to people's house. The first thing I see, if I see a landscape wood, like a railroad tile hanging around there, the first thing I like to try to flip it over to see if there's termite or not. And I start kind of wondering what's going on. I poke the finger in there. You know, that's that kind of thing we do. Kind of habit.
It's kind of habit for him. And this is kind of what it felt like wandering around a Fort Lauderdale neighborhood with Sue's research assistant, Thomas Chauvin. He took us on that tour at the beginning of the program. After walking back and forth across the street several times, going from tree to windowsill to wooden post. Now, remember, he came here from France to study specifically termites. He reminded us that many of us have chosen to live and work here after all, and live and work here among all the bugs and pests that are here natively, but also have been brought here too.
You're in Florida, you have to live with it. And it's one thing, a lot of people come from other places in the world that they don't have that bug environment that we have down here, and they get shocked, but this is the reality. You come in Florida, be prepared, because they're gonna have a lot of bugs, and they're gonna come in houses. Ants of the big pest control industry that we have here to keep the pressure down, but we'll never get rid of them. We can contain them and we can live with them.
Wanda Miles is our technical director. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening this week.
Look who's calling up my wall. Black and hairy, very small. Hanging by a little thread.